I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. The Associated Press is running a four-part series this month on the health and future of Social Security. Almost 60 million Americans are enjoying the benefits of the program, and nearly 160 million workers are contributing to it through their payroll tax. The AP asked in their first story, is Social Security still a good deal for workers? Stephen Olemacher, the lead author, writes that today's retirees are the first generation of workers who will get less out of the program than they put into it. We asked him to join us on Radio Times, and we'll get two perspectives from Michael Tanner, senior fellow at the Cato Institute, and from Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Stephen Olemacher is a congressional reporter for the AP and joins us by telephone, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Why did you want to do this series?
Well, because Social Security is so important to just about every American. It touches nearly every American family. It's the federal government's largest program, and as you pointed out, there's more than 56 million people who get benefits and almost 160 million people who pay Social Security taxes. Now, Social Security has long-term financial problems. Those problems are not immediate. I think it's important to note that. You know, it's not going to run out of money next year, in 5 years, or even in 20 years. But the longer Congress waits to make changes to Social Security, you know, the harder it gets to tackle those problems. And so, but the beauty of Social Security is that it's fixable. And so I think that makes it a prime candidate for Congress as they start to, you know, address the nation's long-term fiscal problems next year. It makes it a prime candidate for action. So we're in the middle of a presidential election. Congressional elections are going on. And our members, you know, want, you know, in-depth stories about issues and issues that matter to people. And so when I look at Social Security is an issue that matters to quite a few people.
Indeed, and we'll get to all of that. What is the average monthly payment that a recipient gets?
It's a little over $1,200 for a retiree. I believe it's like $1,235. And for a disabled worker, it's a little over $1,100.
And would it be fair to say, even looking back on the history of Social Security, that it has helped to prevent older people from falling into poverty once they retire, for instance?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I think that's one of the reasons why Social Security is so popular, that, you know, when it has helped millions of people and over numerous generations stay out of poverty.
Now, you did find, and I quoted from you in this first story, that the generation of workers retiring today are going to get less out of the program than they put into it. Put some flesh and bones on that for us.
Well, okay, so when you think about when Social Security was first started, the Social Security Act was passed in 1935. The payroll taxes were first imposed in 1937, and benefits came out, the first monthly benefits came out in 1940. Now, when Social Security first started, there were a lot more workers per retiree and per beneficiary than there are today. So the taxes, the payroll taxes that people paid, could be considerably lower. In fact, the first tax was only 2%, 1% paid by the worker and 1% paid by the employee. And that number did not go above 6% until 1960. So what happens is, you know, a lot of people paid in at relatively low tax rates, and yet they got benefits for the rest of their lives. And so, say if you retired in 1960, you could expect a rate of return of about 7 to 1. 7 times what you paid into it, you're going to get back in benefits. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that you didn't start paying Social Security taxes right until 1937. So, you know, move that forward a little bit. Even in 1985, according to data from the Social Security Administration, people at every single income level could expect to get more back in benefits after they retire than they pay in taxes. Now, keep in mind, you know, these are average numbers and for people who live the expected life expectancy.
Well, in fact, I was thinking about demographics and the fact that people are living longer today than they did in the 1930s or 40s. How does that affect these benefits?
Sure, sure. In fact, you know, I think one of the lines that I use in the story is, if you want to get more benefits, the best way to do that is to live longer. But, you know, the issue is that today the Social Security tax is 12.4%. It's actually down to 10.4% because we had a temporary Social Security tax reduction. But, you know, next year it's supposed to go back to 12.4%, which is considerably higher than it had been, even before 1990. So you know, what's happening is then, I'm sorry, go back to, what was your question again?
Well, that's okay. We're talking numbers on the radio, and that's always that's always a tricky thing. But I wondered, does this, if you're talking about people who are putting more into the system than they're getting out of it, is that true for low-income workers, middle-income workers, high-income workers? Do you see that across the board?
Oh, sure, sure. Great question. Because Social Security benefits are progressive, low-income workers will actually continue to get a little bit more in benefits than they pay in taxes well into the future. High-income workers actually started to pay more in taxes than they receive in benefits back in the 90s. So what's happening right now is the people in the middle-income workers. And by middle-income workers, we're talking about people who make about $41,000, $42,000, $43,000 a year. That is where the shift is happening, and that is what, you know, that is what's tipped the scale from, you know, being most of the people receiving more in benefits than they got in taxes to the other way around.
I was thinking about the of car insurance as I was reading your article, and I would say, using myself as an example, I've probably paid out much more in car insurance than I've actually used to fix a car from an accident. And the idea of Social Security is, yes, to help individuals in their retirement, but isn't it also there to help everybody in retirement?
You know, absolutely. Yeah, that's a great point. You know, one of the issues that I raised in the story, and I think I quoted somebody as saying this, is that, you know, Social Security is about more than just the returns that you get back from it. It's, you know, you get guaranteed lifetime benefits that are adjusted for inflation. Your spouse can get benefits even if they never earned wages. Children can get benefits if they have a working parent who dies young. And if you become too disabled to work, then you can qualify for lifetime benefits as well. I was talking to Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, and he's a passionate advocate for Social Security, and he said Social Security is not an investment program, it's an insurance program.
Right, and that's why it's called Social Security, right?
Yes.
But I also wonder, if people are paying more into it than they're getting out of it, wouldn't that tell us that there is a healthy surplus in Social Security?
Well, you know, first of all, you know, you step back, if you talk about the surplus, you know, one of the reasons why, you know, Social Security is an insurance program, and I think it is important to talk about the benefits other than just the returns that you get. However, it's also important to look at the, you know, our relationship with Social Security going forward, because as we need to make changes, you know, it's healthy, I think, to know where we stand and what we would like to see the program look like going forward. Social Security does have a surplus. And what's happened is, back in the 1980s, when they last made changes to Social Security, Social Security started generating more tax revenue than it paid out in benefits. And what happened over that time is, you know, the surpluses were built up, and they're about $2.7 trillion today. But about 2 years ago, Social Security started paying out more in benefits than it collects in tax revenue. Now, the surplus is still growing a little bit because it gets interest payments as well. Mm-hmm. However, the trustees who oversee Social Security project that that surplus, which are in trust funds, will be exhausted by 2033. And at that point, the program will only collect enough tax revenue to pay about 75% of benefits.
But would it be fair to say, even looking back, that the Social Security surplus has been used by the government to pay for government programs and has actually hid the budget deficit from it's ended up covering up for the budget deficit and making it look smaller than it actually is?
Sure, sure, sure. You know, the way it works is that as Social Security built up these surpluses, they, by law, didn't just put that money in the bank and sit on the cash.
Right.
They invested in Treasury bonds, and the federal government took the revenue from those Treasury bonds and did what it does with all the revenue it gets from Treasury bonds. It spent it. So that is why when you'll sometimes hear some advocates claim that, you know, Congress has raided Social Security.
Right.
Well, you know, but so that money has been spent on other programs. However, they issued these Treasury bonds to Social Security, which, you know, come with the full faith and credit of the United States government.
But those bonds, I mean, it looks like either outside foreign countries or people are still willing to invest in the United States, at least so far.
That is correct. And if in talking to the Commissioner of the Social Security Administration, and he says, look, you know, we've made these investments in the safest investment that there is, and in fact, it's the investment that's required by law for us to do. Now, you raise a good point about how Social Security has masked the size of the deficit in the past. You know, if we look back and you ask somebody in Congress, you know, how many years was the federal budget in balance back in the 1990s when President Clinton was president? And a lot of people will say, well, it was 4 years. They balanced the budget for 4 years. They had surpluses. Well, only two of those years would have been surpluses if it wasn't for the surplus in the Social Security trust funds.
And that's something that we should know about the way that that government works, and certainly the way that the budget works as well. So is Social Security in trouble?
Okay, well, Social Security has long-term financial problems. And, you know, but it's important to step back and say again that those problems are not immediate. However, the problem gets harder to fix the longer Congress waits. And so, you know, as 2033 approaches, when the trust funds will be exhausted, you know, that very next year, the deficit, the gap between how much taxes would be collected and how much benefits are scheduled to be paid out is very big. It's, you know, it's over $600 billion, and it grows, you know, very fast after that. So, you know, most of the experts you talk to, including the officials at the Social Security Administration and the trustees, write up in their annual reports every year that the sooner Congress acts, they'll have the ability to make more subtle changes that can be phased in over time. And the longer Congress waits to act, those changes would have to be more dramatic if they want to prevent this big 25% cut in benefits come 2033.
And does that make Social Security different from Medicare or Medicaid in that if people want to fix the program, it is actually fixable?
Yes, well, I wouldn't say that none of them are fixable. I mean, all these problems are fixable, but Social Security, in comparison to, say, Medicare and Medicaid, is easier. Now, that's not to say it's easy. These are all very difficult decisions, and all of these solutions that people can come up with, whether it's raising taxes or cutting benefits, will affect millions of people, and so they are difficult decisions. However, when you're talking about Medicare and Medicaid, which, by the way, Medicare and Medicaid are bigger problems for the federal government. They are going to be a much larger drain on the finances of the federal government in the future than Social Security. However, in order to fix Medicare and Medicaid, you have to figure out a way to tame the rising cost of health care, which there is no consensus that I know of in Washington on how to do that. There's a lot of ideas for how to do that, but that's a very difficult thing to do. And the beauty of Social Security is you don't have to deal with that kind of an issue. So it is fixable. And I think, and that is why when I talk to people in Congress about, you know, the prospects of addressing Social Security in the next year or so, they put it very high on the list because it is something that could be done, and since it is fixable, it makes it much more likely that there would be action.
Well, I want to pick up on that after this very short break. That's Stephen Olemacher. He's a congressional reporter for the Associated Press, lead author of their series running this summer on Social Security. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Brandywine River Museum supports WHYY and presents tours of Andrew Wyeth's studio. The artist's private retreat is now open for tours. Visitors can see where Wyeth created some of his iconic works of art, learn about their creative process, and see his library, photos, brushes, paints, and much more. Tours take place Tuesdays through Sundays. Details about Andrew Wyeth's studio tours are available online at brandywinemuseum.org.
Next time in Studio 360, this respectable, straight-laced, middle-aged couple becomes obsessed with the dance of passion.
They say, but you don't look like somebody who's danced tango. I probably look very nerdy.
Blame it on the tango. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Linnea Johnson was the kind of bright, sensitive teen mothers worry about. A job made infinitely harder when sensitive became suicidal.
The darkest spot was when she said, just let me go.
Perfect Chaos, a new memoir that tells a mother-daughter fight for mental health. That's next time on Tell Me More.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We are talking in this hour of the show about the health and future of Social Security. Stephen Allemacher, our guest for the first half of the program, again, a congressional reporter for the Associated Press, lead author of the AP series this summer on Social Security. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stephen, before I get to some of our callers here in terms of what could be done to change some of the formula for Social Security, one would be to raise the retirement age.
That is correct. In fact, the President Obama appointed a deficit commission back in 2010, and one of the recommendations it had was for gradually increasing the retirement age over time. To get full benefits today, you have to be 66 years old. That is increasing to 67 for people born in 1960 or later.
And raising the wage cap, it's capped at what, about $110,000?
It is. Right now, Social Security taxes are applied to the first $110,100 in wages that people make. And one option would be to raise that cap so that more wages are subject to the tax.
And, of course, it could be a reduction of benefits as well, or maybe even means testing benefits?
Well, it could be. In fact, one of the ways... Now, there's a complicated formula for calculating your initial benefits that you start with, and you can make small changes to that would have very big effects and save a lot of money. However, if you think about it, the more money you save, that means the bigger the benefit cut for people.
Let me get some callers in, and we have Jerry called us up from Woodtown. And Jerry, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Sure.
Oh, dear. We have a terrible phone line. Jerry, if you don't mind calling back, and we'll get you on the air. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stephen, before we get back to our callers here, changing, reforming Social Security, always called, the third rail of politics. Do you think that's still true?
Well, it's difficult. And like I said, because people get... have an emotional attachment to Social Security. I mean, if you think about it, one of the beauties of Social Security is that it is an earned benefit. And so, when you talk to people after they've worked their whole lives and paid into it for most of their lives, they feel, they are entitled to those benefits. So whenever you talk about making changes, it is very difficult.
Right. You quoted, I believe it was the head of the AARP, said an interesting thing, that Social Security is in pretty good shape. This would be compared to other programs in the government. We know that there's some pretty serious programs under attack or certainly being looked at in Washington. Would you say that's a fair assessment?
Well, I would say this, that there is no consensus in Washington on the urgency to act. And since the Social Security surplus is not scheduled to run out until 2033.
Right.
It gives Congress a cushion. But what I keep going back to, and everyone I talk to, and folks, including the folks at AARP, who say, it would be better to act sooner. The sooner you do these things, the more subtle the changes can be. That way they can be phased in over time so that people who are working today can have more time to prepare and save more, or prepare to work longer if they had to. And it could be done in a way that people who are currently getting benefits wouldn't necessarily have to be affected if Congress chose to go that way.
Because it's different from other programs in that it's supposed to be self-sustaining, right?
Yes, it is. In fact, and that's part of the beauty of Social Security, and that has kept it insulated a little bit from the rest of Congress, not completely insulated, is that you pay payroll taxes. And that is what funds the benefits. Now, one important thing to remember about how the system works is that when you're paying your payroll taxes over the course of your career, that money is not going into an account that's being held for you.
Right.
What happens is that people who are working today pay taxes, and that money is going to pay benefits who are retired today. And so that is one of the reasons why Social Security is having the financial problems going forward, is because of the demographic changes that are happening in this country. Back in 1960, there were 5 workers for every person receiving benefits, and today there's a little less than 3 workers for every person getting benefits, and by 2035, the Congressional Budget Office says there will be less than 2 workers.
And we're also talking about this bubble of baby boomers who are starting to retire.
Exactly. And it's not, it's funny, it's not so much that the baby boomers are retiring, it's that the baby boomers didn't have enough kids.
They didn't have enough kids in order to keep the supply of workers supporting the program.
Sure, sure. Birth rates, or as demographers like to say, fertility rates in the country declined after the baby boom. In fact, that's the definition of the baby boom. It's just that from 1946 to 1964, birth rates in the United States went up, and after that, they came down. Some good news for the United States is that the fertility rates in the United States are not as low as they are in places like Europe, which are facing much more serious problems with their government retirement programs because of that.
Well, in fact, yeah, some of the reporting here looks at the difference when it comes to benefits and retirement ages, and Europe is quite different from the United States.
It is quite different. In the United States, the expectation is that American workers will get much more of their retirement earnings from private pensions or personal savings than in many European countries. Up until very recently, in many European countries, you could retire and get full benefits much earlier than in the United States. That has been changing, and
yes,
in fact, that's caused more than a little unrest in some of the countries over in Europe.
So tell us again, what happens at 2033?
Okay, in 2033, the Social Security trust funds, there are two, one for the retirement program and one for the disability program, are scheduled to essentially become exhausted and run out of money. Now, that doesn't mean Social Security is broke, because at that time, Social Security will collect enough taxes, payroll taxes and taxes on benefits, to pay about 75% of benefits. Now, under the law, Social Security has the authorization to pay out full benefits to everyone who has earned them until the trust funds become exhausted. And once the trust funds become exhausted, then Social Security can only pay out in benefits the money it collects in taxes. So that would trigger about a 25% cut in benefits come 2033, if Congress does not act before then.
And do you get a sense that Congress does want to act on this?
Well, I will say that I've not met a member of Congress yet who is running for re-election on the platform of cutting Social Security benefits by 25%. So, yes, they do. They just—it's a matter of a difference of opinion on the urgency, and of course, obviously, on the course of action.
And I'm curious. The Social Security tax was reduced at the end of 2010. What has been the impact of that on the Social Security pile of money?
Well, when Congress imposed the cut, so Social Security taxes are usually 12.4% on wages. The worker pays 6.2%, and the employer pays 6.2%. And the cut was just for the employee share, down to 4.2%. And when Congress did this, they said this is not going to have any effect on the Social Security financing and trust funds. We will replenish those funds with money from the rest of the government, which essentially, since they didn't do anything to raise revenue or cut spending elsewhere to do that, they're financing that through borrowing.
And what's been the reader response to your series so far?
It's been fantastic. I've received quite a few emails. I follow it on Sundays when the stories come out on Twitter, and it's been a lot of response there. It's been really great because, as I said, this is such an important issue to so many people, and it touches so many American lives that we knew it would have a lot of interest, and it has.
And we're about halfway through the series, or you're about halfway through the series. What's coming up next, and then we'll have to say goodbye to you, Stephen.
What's coming up next this Sunday is we're looking at some of the options to fix Social Security. And as I said, the beautiful thing about Social Security is that it is fixable, and we're going to look at a lot of different options. There are two broad categories for solutions to fix Social Security, either raise taxes or cut benefits, but there are many options within those. And so we're going to be looking at those. And then after that, we're doing a poll, and we're going to write a story about what Americans think.
Well, fair enough. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
All right. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And that's Stephen Olemacher. He's a congressional reporter for the Associated Press and lead writer for the AP series on Social Security, which has been running Sundays this month. Well, joining us now is Michael Tanner. He's been listening in, senior fellow with the Cato Institute, architect of the Cato's Project on Social Security Choice. And Michael Tanner, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Been a couple of years.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure, of course.
Dean Baker also joins us as well, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. That's in Washington, D.C., as is the Cato Institute. His blog is called Beat the Press. And Dean Baker, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me on.
And we're talking about Social Security, past, present, and future, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Dean Baker, let me start with you, and then Michael Tanner, I'll get you in on the conversation as well. From your perspective, Dean Baker, is Social Security in trouble?
No, and you know, I have to say, I feel Stephen's pieces have really been irresponsible, because what he's done is he's thrown out a lot of really big numbers without any context. And, you know, just seriously, no one, I'm willing to bet that less than 0.01% of his readers have any idea what a deficit of $7 trillion in 2085 means. I mean, this is just totally irresponsible. What we have to do is look at these numbers in some context, and when you do that, it's very hard to say the program faces any serious difficulties. There's little differences between the trustees' projections and the Congressional Budget Office projections, but if we look at the Congressional Budget Office projections, the program could pay every penny of benefit through the year 2038. Even if we never did anything, it would be able to pay about 80% of all future benefits through the rest of the century. Then you go, okay, suppose you want to make up the shortfall, different ways you could do it. You could eliminate the cap on taxable wages. You could raise the payroll tax, just to give you an idea of what that would mean. If you increase the payroll tax by an amount equal to 5% of projected wage growth over the next 30 years, that would keep the program fully solvent for the rest of the century. So the idea of this facing some incredible burden, if you put the numbers in context so people can understand it, I think it's pretty hard to say that's an incredible burden.
Well, let me turn to you, Michael Tanner. Is Social Security in trouble?
It's in far more trouble, I think, than the report actually indicated. I think that the report actually underestimates the effect on the current budget. For example, it talks about the Social Security Trust Fund. Well, no doubt that that Social Security Trust Fund can continue to pay benefits until 2037 or so, but the only way it can do so is by redeeming the bonds in the trust fund, and those bonds have to be redeemed out of general revenues. In fact, there's $2.9 trillion of bonds in there right now, every penny of which will have to be paid back out of general revenues. Well, if you haven't noticed, the federal government doesn't have $2.9 trillion sitting around these days. The only way it can get that money is through raising taxes, borrowing it, or from cutting other programs. So Social Security begins to act as a squeeze on the general budget. And while we can look at the cost over just 75 years, which is sort of the actuarial period arbitrarily defined by law, if you actually want to look at Social Security's total unfunded liabilities, they're in excess of $22 trillion. And that's the sort of the, not that there'll be $22 trillion someday in the distant future, but that's the discounted present value today, meaning that if we had $22 trillion laying around that we could stick in the bank at 3% interest, then we'd have enough money to pay back all the benefits that we've promised. The simple fact is Social Security cannot pay the benefits that are promised with current tax revenue.
Well, let me go back to you, Dean Baker. And Michael Tanner talked about the trust fund and also the unfunded liabilities. What do you say?
Well, the trust fund are U.S. government bonds that the fund Social Security purchased with its surplus in prior years, and that poses a cost to the U.S. government in the same way that, you know, Mitt Romney, I haven't looked at his assets, but if he owes $100 million in U.S. government bonds, he intends to cash those in to use for his campaign, would any of us say Mitt Romney's in trouble? You know, this was the way the fund was established. Now, Mike might not like it, but that's the law. So that's not Social Security's problem. You might want to say the government's actually more indebted than people realize, although I'm not sure, because, you know, when we talked about the debt ceiling last summer, that number included the money owed to Social Security. So that was very prominent. So I'm not really sure what the point here is. And in terms of the unfunded liabilities, there's a lot of different ways we can cut it. But again, I think what just makes the most sense, this is the number that CBO uses and the trustees use. If we say how much would you have to raise taxes, again, not the only way or necessarily the best way to do it, how much would we have to raise taxes to have the program fully funded? If we took about 5% of projected wage growth over the next three decades, that would keep us fully funded for the rest of the century. I mean, we could look at 2210 or whatever, but I think most people would be pretty satisfied if we could, you know, say here we have it to 2200 or 2100. And well, the fund's fully solvent.
Well, let me get out of some of the numbers, as important as they are, but let me turn back to you, Michael Tanner. And when you read polls about Social Security, it is a popular program, whether you or anyone else likes it.
Well, there's no doubt that the people who are on it are very happy with it. I'm not sure if you went out and, you know, and asked younger people whether they think they're going to get everything they paid in. They would be quite as happy with it. In fact, most polls show that younger people don't think that they can rely on Social Security in retirement, aren't sure it's going to be there for them, and are much more open to reforming it than seniors. And certainly, if I was a politician, I'd make sure that any reform that I put in place didn't affect current seniors, simply reflecting political reality.
And do you see those generational differences, Dean Baker?
Well, I think there's some generational differences in the sense that the people who are getting it know that it's there for them. And there has been a huge effort. I mean, you have people like, you know, the Wall Street investment banker Peter Peterson has spent, you know, over $1 billion. I mean, he's open about this. I mean, it's not like a conspiracy. He's been very public in, you know, basically efforts to undermine support for Social Security and Medicare. So given that there's been a lot of money spent trying to convince people that these programs are going down the tubes and won't be there, you know, it's no doubt that that's had some effect. So you have a lot of people in their 20s, 30s, even 40s who don't think it'll be there for them. Now, if you say program will be there for you, what do you think of it? It has overwhelming support, even among younger people. But again, if you convince people they'll never see it, I'm actually surprised how many people in their 20s and 30s still support it, given that they say they think they'll never see it. So it's just they think it's, you know, a program, it's good for the people who have, and they're still willing to support it, even though many of them think they may never benefit from it.
But do you think, Michael Tanner, that people investing privately in their retirement will get the kind of return on that investment and get the kind of security that they want and need in their senior years?
Oh, I think there's little doubt about it. I think that, you know, if you look at the historic rates of return from private capital, it grossly exceeds that from Social Security. Social Security for a person retiring today will return about 1.2% on what they paid in. For younger people, many of them will not live long enough to get back everything they paid in, as you heard earlier. So I think if you just want to look at rates of return, private capital does a much better job, especially over the long term, where the ups and downs of the market don't really matter that much. If you invest over the long term, you'd be much better off.
Dean Baker, we have about a minute before our break here. I'd like to get you to respond to that.
Yeah, well, actually, most people will get much better return than 1.2%. The Urban Institute's done some very good analysis. But more importantly, the point is that Social Security should be people's core retirement income. This is money that people know they can count on. And, you know, those of us who have been alive the last 15 years, we know the stock market does not give a stable return. It's great for people to have extra money to put aside in the stock market, 401k, whatever it might be. But the point is we need that core retirement income there. And those people who have seen the crashes in 2000, 2002, and then again in 2009, I really don't understand how you can question that.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He also has a blog called Beat the Press, featuring commentary on economic reporting. Michael Tanner is a senior fellow with the Cato Institute, architect of the Cato's Project on Social Security Choice. And we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, and open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What should be done, if anything, with Social Security? We'll be right back.
A stroke can rob us of our ability to speak, to move, to understand. The new Mainline Health Neurovascular Center at Bryn Mawr Hospital uses an interventional approach to the rapid treatment of stroke and aneurysm. Formed in collaboration with stroke experts from Jefferson's Faculty Practice Plan and the Jefferson Neuroscience Network, they use minimally invasive techniques to avoid open brain surgery, to prevent disabilities, and to save lives. The Mainline Health Neurovascular Center at Bryn Mawr Hospital supports WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, global weirdness, heat waves, relentless drought, and rising seas. We speak with Michael Lemonick of the group Climate Central, an independent journalism and research organization which has just published a new guide to what we know about the science of climate change and what to expect in the future. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. What's behind the increase in Afghanistan of green-on-blue violence? People in green Afghan army uniforms killing NATO troops. Also, the wildly popular 50 Shades of Grey finally spawns a parody, the far more risque 50 Shades of Earl Grey. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, getting two different perspectives on the health and future of Social Security from Michael Tanner and Dean Baker. And we're taking calls. Looks like, in fact, just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Jerry from Woodson to join us, or Woodstown, I should say. Jerry, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Cole Hamels makes $600,000 a baseball game. He's paid his Social Security taxes by the second inning. I pay about the same Social Security taxes as Warren Buffett. My secretary pays about half the Social Security taxes of Warren Buffett. This is not equitable. The $112,000 limit on income is ridiculous. Somebody who makes $20, $30 million a year can afford to pay more than 5.6% on the first $112,000. If you raise that limit to $5 million, I don't think you'd hurt the guy making $5 million.
Well, Jerry, and this has been an issue that's been discussed and debated. Let me give Michael Tanner a chance to weigh in on that. What do you think, Michael?
Well, sure. Well, first of all, the he's paying 12.4% on that first $106,000, not 5.4. But if you raise it all the way up, you would effectively give the United States the highest marginal tax rates in the world. We'd have a higher marginal tax rate than Sweden. Don't forget, if the president gets what he's currently calling for in tax increases now, we'd have a marginal tax rate of about 54%. So this would raise it up beyond that about another 12% or so, well, with deduction, everything would be less than that. But let's say 55, 56% marginal tax rate. That's going to have a serious impact on investment and productivity in this country. And you get very little out of it. The reality is, if you took that cap off, and in exchange for that, you gave people no additional benefits, because right now, if you pay more taxes, you're going to get more benefits. But let's take all the additional benefits away. You would actually gain 7 years of cash flow solvency under this.
Dean Baker, is the payroll tax regressive?
The payroll tax is very regressive, and I have to take issue with Michael's numbers. You, according to the projections from the Social Security trustees, you would pretty much close the gap completely if you eliminated the cap altogether. If you paid benefits from it, it comes a little shy of that. But the other point to make about that is one of the reasons why we're facing a projected shortfall is so much income has been redistributed over the top. There's had a lot of policies that have redistributed before tax income to higher-end earners. And if you go back to 83, 90% of wage income was covered by the cap. Today, it's less than 83%. If we had maintained 90% of wage income, currently we'd have a cap of about $200,000. That would eliminate somewhere around 50% of the shortfall, projected shortfall, right there. So the huge upward redistribution of income that we've seen over the last three decades has played a big role in Social Security's projected shortfall.
Well, the problem with this whole exercise is this using this trust fund accounting measure. What happened is if we raise taxes today, the additional money would go into the Social Security trust fund. It would be used to buy government bonds, and then it would be spent by the federal government on whatever the federal government spends money on, you know, invading Middle Eastern nations, building roads and bridges, or whatever it might be, and that money would be gone. Someday in the future, then, we'd have to redeem those new bonds that we just bought, which means the federal government would have to go back to Americans and tax them a second time in order to repay the bonds that we bought with the taxes the first time. What really counts is cash flow, not the amount of accumulation in the trust fund.
Do you agree with that,
Michael,
Dean?
Well, Michael, you're welcome not to like it, but that's the law. And, you know, the idea that the government is somehow limited, the idea that the government is somehow limited in how much it takes in from Social Security, you must have missed it, but we have a big deficit right now. So if we wanted to invade another Middle East nation, we don't need the extra money from Social Security to do it. We would just go and spend it. So I don't really understand what your point here is.
Well, you know what? Let me just jump in here, because I do want to get some more callers, and we could go back and forth. Let me get Jesse from King of Prussia to join us on Radio Times. Jesse, go ahead.
Yes.
You're on the air.
Yes, I'm there. Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. Go ahead.
Okay. I think part of the problem with this extreme debate and political aspect to all of this has to do with some subtle ageism in American society, and I think it has to do with the size of generations. But what this says to me, a 70-year-old who thinks Social Security is necessary for myself and for future generations, is that we have to get organized and convince the younger generations not only that they like Social Security, but that they indeed will get what they deserve out of it. Will get full benefits. Will get what a substantial amount of what they paid in. And we just have to get very political about this and convince the younger generations. And that I hope you'll have a program on this so that we can. The older people can start talking about this and convince the youngers.
Well, I appreciate the call, Jesse, and let me give our guests a chance to respond. And Michael, I'm going to go to you first and then to you, Dean.
Well, I just think that Social Security, whatever it has served well in the past, is not going to serve those younger workers the same way in the future. They are either going to pay more in or they are going to get less out. But the fact is, Social Security is basically set up like a Ponzi scheme. And the people, you pay in, the money you pay in isn't saved for you. Instead, it goes to support people who had paid in previously. And when the demographics shift and you have fewer and fewer people paying in to support more and more retirees, it means ultimately the burden on those new workers becomes unsustainable. Mm-hmm. And I think that it simply becomes a bad deal.
But D-Maker, is it a Ponzi scheme or an insurance policy?
Well, it's a Ponzi scheme.
Well, hold on. Michael, hold on. Let me give Dean Baker a chance.
Sure. It is an insurance policy. We've already seen the bulk of the demographic shift. I love Erskine Bowles runs around it, or Alan Simpson. We used to have 16 workers to every retiree, and now we just have 3, and soon we'll be down to 2. Well, we've already seen the bulk of that. That's the point. So I agree with this woman completely. I mean, what we really have to do is educate people about what the numbers actually show, get behind the scare tactics, the trillions of dollars in this. Put it in a context people could understand. Because when you start talking about $50 trillion in the year, no one has any idea what GDP is going to be in 2080. So when you explain it to people, this is how much it is relative to your wages, I find people understand that. And, you know, again, most people hugely support the program. And, you know, I don't care if people decide, looking at the facts, they'd rather see cuts in benefits. That's their call. But mm-hmm. I think it's really important for them to understand what the facts are. And unfortunately, I think there's been a big effort to mislead them.
But are you saying, Dean, that you just can't project that far into the future, that those numbers are meaningless?
Well, no. 2 points about it. One, certainly our projections are fraught with a lot of error, you know, and anyone who's gone back to 2007 and so on, seen the projections for 2008 and 9, you know, people, our forecasters missed the collapse of the housing bubble. So our projections are fraught with a lot of error. But my point more importantly is that when you take a big number from 40, 50, 60 years in the future, no one, Michael and I, have our nose in the data. So we know what that means. But if you tell, you know, and it's not, I think people aren't educated, it's just that people have other things to do in their life than to know what the projected GDP is in 2080. Mm. So if we want to express that in a meaningful way, let's say here's what the needed tax increase would be relative to your wages in that year, something like that. So people understand percents. People are smart. They understand percents. You give them a number, you know, $20 trillion in the year 2080, they have no idea what you just said. You just said a really big number. That's all they know what you said.
Well, Michael, let me go back to you and something that I'm holding in my hand here from the Cato Handbook for Policymakers, number 17, Social Security. Congress should, quote, allow workers to privately invest at least half of their Social Security payroll taxes through individual accounts. Would that not, in the end, sink Social Security?
Well, what it would do is change the nature of Social Security to a program in which we don't have any savings or investment to one in which actual savings and investment occurs. Right now, when you pay your Social Security taxes, none of that money is saved for your retirement or put away or invested in anything. Instead, we would have a system in which at least some of that money would actually be put away for your own retirement, would belong to you, would not be subject to changes from future Congresses. They wouldn't have the right to take away benefits, which they currently do. And it would actually be invested in real assets that would both benefit the economy and earn a higher rate of return.
But would I make those investments under your plan? Would I decide where that money was going to go?
Well, within limits, much the way the federal thrift savings program works for federal employees. Right now, you know, your congressman is investing privately. Now, they have Social Security. Let's not go into this sort of internet myth that, you know, Congress doesn't pay Social Security. They do. But in addition to that, they're investing privately. And I figure, you know, the average American is as smart as their congressman.
But the question is whether they have actual money to invest. But let me turn to you, Dean Baker, give you a chance to respond to that, then we'll get back to our callers.
Well, as smart as their congressman has Social Security, so they're investing on top of that. And again, I'm fine with that. I think it's great that, you know, and I've worked with people, even the conservatives, about trying to design systems to make it easier for people to have access to investment vehicles. I think that's great. We're talking about getting rid of people's Social Security. And in terms of its impact on the economy, at least in the short term, unless, you know, Michael and his friends want to take away people's benefits, that's going to mean larger budget deficits, because we're committed to paying benefits for people today, decades into the future. So it's not as though we're creating additional savings in the economy. We're just shuffling that around. We're going to say money that used to go to pay people's benefits will instead be made up by additional borrowing from the government so that we could put people's money in these private accounts, which, by the way, I should point out, have hugely higher administrative costs than the Social Security system. If we look at the system in Chile that at least Cato used to hold up as a model, I don't know if it's still their model, the administrative costs of the Chilean system are 20 to 30 times higher than the administrative costs of the U.S. Social Security system, which is a lot of money to throw in the garbage.
Is that true, Michael?
Well, the administrative costs are high in Chile. There's some certainly, although they've been coming down rapidly in recent years because they made some important changes to the program. But the Social Security Administration estimates that personal accounts in this country would run about 40 basis points or 0.4% of the assets managed. And other people estimate that it could be far less than that.
Let me get Lynn from Overbrook to join our conversation. Lynn, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
My question has to do with those who advocate an increase in the retirement age, because last night I looked through some funeral programs that I have in my drawer. I had 72 of them, and none of the black males lived to be 62 years old. And I know it's only been in recent years that African-American males have lived long enough to collect Social Security. And I'm wondering, you know, it's almost as if poor people and African-Americans subsidize or underwrite Social Security for others. So when I hear this, any kind of discussion about increasing the age of retirement, this concerns me, and I would like for your guest to speak to that. Thank you.
You're welcome, Len. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Dean Baker, I'm going to give you a chance to respond first.
Yeah, well, I'd be very strongly opposed to it for exactly the reasons the gentleman was saying, that, you know, the life expectancy of black males is still only around 65. We've had increases in life expectancy over the last several decades, but disproportionately those have gone to higher income earners. So if you look at the gains for people in the bottom half of the income distribution, those have been very limited, and we have already raised the normal retirement age from 65 to 67. So I'm not anxious to go further. Just one quick point I want to get back to. The numbers that were just cited about the administrative costs, those are consistent with what I just said. That's about 25 times the administrative cost of Social Security. So that's, again, a lot of money to give away to the financial industry.
Michael, is Len right that the poor end up subsidizing the more well-off?
Yeah, he absolutely is. I actually have to agree with Dean on this. I mean, the fact is about one out of every three African-American men pays into Social Security and dies before they collect Social Security benefits. And if they don't have children under the age of 18, that means that their Social Security payments are simply gone. They're not passed on. They're not inherited. That wealth doesn't go to their family. So I think that that's one of the problems with the existing Social Security system. In a system in which there were personal investment accounts, that money that the person had contributed over their life actually would be inheritable. It would actually be part of their estate. So what they paid in, if they died early, they'd get it.
I'm confused, because I thought under Social Security that surviving spouses would get those benefits, and even surviving children. Paul Ryan's father died when he was a teenager, and he
but you have to be under the age of 18
in order to get those benefits.
The children's benefits.
Right.
That's correct.
But the surviving spouse does get benefits.
A spouse would get benefit at age 65.
Okay, fair enough. Let me get Steve from Huntington County to join us on Radio Times. And Steve, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just had kind of a quick question. I've been paying taxes for about, you know, 30 years. I've heard this argument over and over again. And, you know, for the person kind of in the middle here, I hear one side and I hear the other side, and I don't have to interpret who's right. I just wonder if where's the compromise, and how can we get together to solve this rather than have this ongoing argument?
It's a fair question, Stephen. And Dean Bigger, I'll put that first to you and then to you, Michael Tanner. Is there middle ground, Dean?
Well, I'm not really sure. I mean, I think the main issue, again, is the public has to be informed about the program, and obviously you'd like it to be a democratic choice. And what I think is really unfortunate, you know, as Michael was saying earlier, you have a lot of people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s who don't think they'll see a penny from the program. And, you know, I'm sorry, but that's absurd. You know, so it's very hard to envision a well-worked-out compromise when you have large segments of the public that have really been led to believe something that's totally false about the program. So at the end of the day, this absolutely is a democratic choice. I worry to death that Congress, you know, we talk about a grand bargain, which is likely to involve cuts in Social Security after the election. So I'm sort of like, what's the point of the election that no matter who we vote for, we're going to have, you know, our leadership in Congress and president sit down and do a deal on our most important social program that doesn't involve us?
Well, Michael Tanner, you have about 45 seconds. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think it used to be a much more bipartisan issue, much bigger chance of compromise. There used to be Democrats like Bob Kerry and Pat Moynihan when they were in the Senate that supported the idea of small personal accounts. Even Bill Clinton was moving in that direction at one time, but before the Lewinsky scandal sort of derailed it. So it used to be something that had much bipartisan support. Unfortunately, we're so polarized today, and it's such a wedge issue that many Democrats can use to sort of beat up on Republicans, that I do fear that we're not in a position to compromise today.
Well, Steve, there's your answer. And Michael Tanner, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Anytime.
And he's senior fellow with the Cato Institute. Dean Baker, thank you very much as well.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
You're very welcome. And he's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. And we began our conversation talking with Stephen Olamaka, lead writer of an AP series running this month on Social Security. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us. Do stay with us for the second hour of Radio Times coming up next.